that took me out of myself, that's all. That was why I wanted to study journalism. Amelia was something else. I can't explain it properly. Don't say her name. Another edict. She should expect this, of course, but it still rankled. You were wrapped up in your book. I wanted something like that for me, something that challenged me. So you took a lover? A woman lover? To hear Jack name her relationship with Amelia so directly, after they'd skirted around saying the words, was like a slap in the face. It was finally out in the open. She had been having an affair, betraying her husband and their family. Her cheeks flushed with shame. No. I'm talking about journalism school. They're two separate things. Please don't confuse them. She was just a friend who... He held up his hand. Don't say it. I don't want to hear it. If this gets out, I'll be a laughingstock. My book will never be published. I can't believe you jeopardized all I've worked for. If only he would understand. You had that book, which was all you could talk about for the past many years. You were away nights, working and working, leaving me alone. I didn't mean to hurt you, but that damned book! That damned book is going to put food on our table. But let me tell you, no agent will touch me if it gets out about your unnatural tendencies. The phrase unnatural tendencies was grotesque. Laura's guilt tilted toward anger. As if Jack were such the model husband and father. You love that book more than any of us. Even when Harry was sick, you still crept away to edit. I was under a deadline. Harry nearly died! She stood to go, and he did as well, grabbing her arm. I'm not done talking to you yet. That hurts. Ouch, Jack! A movement near the door caught her eye. While she was sure she'd closed it behind her, now it stood slightly ajar. She stood and looked out just in time to see Harry's back retreating down the hallway. She turned to Jack. Harry was listening. He must have followed me. My God. Jack took off after Harry, and she followed, up the stairs, up to the mezzanine. They couldn't run. There were too many other people about. It would be unseemly. Finally, they reached the apartment. As Laura opened the door, she heard Pearl crying out.
Stop! You can't do that!
In the sitting room, Harry sat staring intently at the fireplace, where bright yellow flames flickered and flared. But Laura hadn't lit a fire that morning. It was far too warm for that. Harry held a poker in his hand and didn't look up at them as they drew closer. The fierceness and sheer glee in his face reminded her of the boys downtown, that day when they'd mocked and taunted her.
Harry, my boy, we should talk, said Jack.
He's burning it!
Pearl was crying, pointing to the fire. Burning what? Asked Laura. But in an instant, she knew the answer. Jack raced to his study and back.
Where's my manuscript? It was on the desk.
Harry didn't answer, just stared into the flames as if hypnotized, where a stack of white pages curled into ash. Chapter 24. New York City, 1914. Jack stood frozen, but only for a moment. Within seconds, he had crossed the room to the fireplace and shoved Harry out of the way, reaching for the burning manuscript with his bare hand before pulling it back with a sharp cry.
We have to save it. Pearl, get water!
Jack grabbed the poker and tried to drag the charred manuscript out as Pearl entered from the kitchen with a pitcher of water. Laura poured the water into the fireplace, but nothing could be saved. It was too late. The three of them stared into the soggy, charred mess. There was nothing left of Jack's masterpiece.
his life's work. Jack slowly turned his head in a way that reminded Laura of a wolf. Deliberate, focused on his prey. Focused on Harry. The boy stood with one palm planted on the dumbwaiter door, the other clenched at his side.
Harry, how could you?
Laura spoke to break the intolerable silence, but as she did, Jack was up and across the room. He slapped the boy once, hard. Harry fell against the door of the dumbwaiter, and Laura cried out, imagining the door giving way and her son falling to his death. Laura ran to Jack and grabbed his arm, holding on tight.
Jack, don't!
Jack turned to her, other hand raised, ready to come down on her own cheek. She flinched, stunned at the fact that she was in combat with her own husband. How had it come to this? She'd never seen such a dark side to Jack, but then she never would have imagined her son could do such a terrible deed. Had they been like this all along, or had she missed it, focused on the happy family she imagined they were? The sudden violence in the room was like an infection, contaminating Laura as well. She was desperate to lash out, to punish. She shoved Jack hard with both hands, the blood in her veins at the boil. In the brief moment that Laura and Jack wrestled, Harry slipped away down the stairs. Jack whirled around and disappeared down the stairs after him as Pearl wrapped her hands around her mother's waist.
Don't leave me. Don't go.
Laura turned to her daughter. I won't. Go to your room, all right? Everything will be fine. We just need everyone to calm down.
But Father's book.
Pearl pointed to the fireplace, but Laura didn't look. She couldn't. Stay in your room. I'm here. I won't leave you. Pearl did as she was told, and Laura, not knowing what to do next, went into Harry's bedroom, where his stuffed lamb sat on the bed, looking desolate. Harry had always been closer to Laura than to Jack. It was just his way. And he'd seen Jack go after Laura in the basement. But to have burned the manuscript in retribution? It was unthinkable. Something she couldn't fathom doing, even after what Jack had said about her relationship with Amelia and their unnatural tendencies. But Harry was so young, and Laura was beginning to grasp now how neglected and misunderstood he must feel. To skip school for months and have neither parent even notice? Not to mention the behaviors Harry might have witnessed with Red Patty and this gang before he became ill. She returned to the staircase and leaned against the banister. These rooms had held such happy memories. The fireplace mantel where Pearl had carefully arranged pine boughs in December. The kitchen where Harry had presented his tooth last year. Her eye went to the place Harry had last stood, watching them as they tried to salvage the manuscript, as if by staring hard enough she could summon him to reappear. Something about the memory was strange, though. The way he'd positioned himself, with one hand flat against the dumbwaiter door, like he was holding it shut. She stepped forward, examining the apparatus closer. A small piece of paper, hardly noticeable, jutted out from the crack at the bottom. They'd never used the dumbwaiter. There was no need. In fact, Jack had warned the children soon after they moved in that they weren't allowed to play with it, that it was too dangerous. She rose and opened the small latch. As the door swung wide, something fluttered to the ground. She reached down and picked it up. A $10 bill. The dumbwaiter car was out of position, a few inches from the top of the opening. Laura pulled on one of the ropes, and it slowly cranked into place. Inside the car sat a wooden box, which she recognized as the one where Harry stored his keepsakes. Why was it here and not in his room? But when she opened it, she knew why. $10 and $20 bills, dozens of them, covered a book. The Tamerlane. The front door opened, and she heard Jack's heavy tread, but not a second one. Harry had escaped, for now. Jack stopped at the top of the stairway. She held up the Tamerlane for him to see. It was here all the time, in the dumbwaiter. He moved closer, breathing hard, and looked down at the contents of the box. What is all this money? He held up a couple of the bills. None of this made sense. Stolen books and hidden money. Nothing in front of her paired up with the sweet boy she loved so very much. She had to come clean, tell Jack what she knew. When Harry wasn't at school, he was hanging with a gang of boys down near Union Square. My guess is he stole the other books as well and sold them. Jack stood frozen for a moment, taking it in. Our own son, the book thief. When were you planning to tell me this, Laura?
I found these just now. I didn't know he was the thief. But the books are locked away. How would he get to them?
He had plenty of opportunity at night, while we slept, to figure that out. We should hand it over to Dr. Anderson.
Laura shook her head. Do you know what they'll do to Harry if we turn him in? He'll be sent away. We don't know the whole story yet.
Jack leaned against the stairway banister, his face white. If we turn this in without Harry, I'll lose my job. I don't have the manuscript anymore, so there's no advance, no income. We've lost everything.
Again, Jack's only care in the world seemed to be for his precious manuscript. But if they were going to figure this out, they would have to come together. For the sake of her children, Laura knew she had to slow her anger and treat her husband like an ally.
What if we say we found the Tamerlane, but don't know how it got here? She suggested.
It was a ridiculous idea, and Jack didn't even bother answering.
We have to find Harry and see if there's another explanation, she finally said.
Maybe the other boys forced him into it.
She moved to get her coat, but Jack stopped her. No. Let him spend the evening out on the streets and see how that feels. Maybe it'll teach him something.
But he's still recovering.
I'm not listening to you anymore, Laura.
Jack didn't bother concealing his impatience.
You can blame yourself for this.
You put your hands on me. That's what set him off. It was your beastly actions that made him angry.
At that, Jack's eyes grew wet. My book. It's gone. My son is a thief. My wife is...
He trailed off. Laura blinked at him. Did it matter to him at all that their family had collapsed around him?
We destroy it then. The Tamerlane.
Laura couldn't believe she was saying this. We don't tell a soul. Then, when Harry returns, we put this family back together again.
Jack regarded the book as if it were poisonous. I need to think. I'm going downstairs.
She encouraged him, knowing that it would be better for him not to be there when Harry returned. She sat down in the big chair by the fire and cried. She cried for her boy, for her husband, for the life she'd imagined she'd be leading, for her arrogance at thinking she deserved more than she had, for the fact that she was willing to destroy a treasured piece of history if it helped keep her family together. She rose and carried the box to the fireplace, placing it on top of the detritus of her husband's writings. But she couldn't light the match. Her fingers shook. The match wouldn't take. And after a couple of tries, she gave up, returning the box to its hiding place. A gentle tug on the rope lifted the box up and out of sight, into the darkness. Laura woke with a start, unsure of where she was, before realizing she'd fallen asleep in the chair by the fire. Her neck and shoulders ached. Harry,
She checked his room, but the bed was still neatly made. There was no sign he'd returned in the night. Pearl, one room over, was fast asleep, her head buried face down in the pillow so that only a messy swath of hair was visible. Yesterday's events, the argument with Jack, the futile effort to save the manuscript, the dumbwaiter's secret contents, washed over her in a painful wave. But the few hours of sleep had brought a renewed energy, a sense that she could fix this, make it right. She must think clearly, and her first goal was to protect her children. Harry shouldn't be punished for something that was completely out of character for him. He was only a young boy and had been through a tough year, had made stupid mistakes. She wished they'd never moved into the library, that they'd stayed upstate, where life was simpler and none of them would have fallen victim to the temptations of the big city. Temptations like a career of her own, like Amelia, like the rare books. Jack was nowhere to be found. He'd probably spent the night downstairs on the sofa in his office. She'd talk with him, convince him to forgive his son. Harry would return today, and they'd have a long discussion, without anger or tears. Without blaming each other. They'd find out why he'd done it, and how. The thought of him out on the streets all night made her ill. But at least he had Red Patty and the gang to run to, which was an odd comfort. A terrible comfort. What if the gang had forced him to steal the books for them? If Harry explained to Dr. Anderson everything he knew and turned in the awful boys who forced him to steal, wouldn't he be offered some leniency? Of course he would. He was only 11 years old. It wasn't lost on her that he'd be turning in the sons of other women, mothers whose own boys had lost their way. But her own family must come first, from now on. She didn't have any compassion to spare. A solid knock on the downstairs door stopped her ruminations. She placed one hand on the door to the dumbwaiter, checking that it was firmly shut, before making her way down the narrow stairs. Mr. Gaylard stood in the hallway, two men in uniform lurking just behind him. She looked around for Harry, but the boy wasn't there. Can I help you?
Mrs. Lyons, may we speak with you a moment? Would you please come with me?
Jack must have said something, mentioned Harry's crime, turned him in as vengeance for his terrible misdeed. She imagined stepping into Mr. Gaylard's office, seeing Jack sitting in one chair, tiny Harry in the other, having to choose. What would an innocent party say to this? She wasn't sure how to respond. It's awfully early. Is something wrong?
We need to talk.
Every fiber of her being resisted being led away. I can't leave the apartment just now.
An officer will stay with the children.
Children? He didn't know that Harry had run off, which meant Harry was safe, for now. She followed him and the other officer out into the hallway, where two librarians walked by, staring at her before quickly averting their eyes. Around the corner, Mr. Benson, the janitor, stood frozen with his mop and bucket as they passed. What was going on? Mr. Gaylard's office was vacant, thank goodness. He asked the police officer to wait outside and gestured for her to take a seat.
Mrs. Lyons, I'm afraid I have some terrible news.
Harry, they must have found him. What if he'd been attacked in the middle of the night? She imagined his limp body lying under one of the lions, where he'd taken refuge in the dark, too scared to come home. He'd been so ill. To have made it through typhoid fever for this? She'd kill Jack for this, she would. What? She needed Mr. Gaylard to tell her quickly, get it over with. Yet another part of her wanted to go back to the apartment, back to the chair, back before she knew her life was going to tilt precariously into danger.
It's your husband.
Jack? What about him?
The coal passer found him in the boiler room not long ago.
Somewhere, a clock chimed.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid he's hanged himself. From the pipes.
They must have it wrong. Jack would never do such a thing.
She said as much, her voice trembling. I'm so sorry.
I don't believe you. I must see him.
I don't think that's a good idea.
He was wrong, and she'd prove it to him. Show me.
Mr. Gaylard held her arm as they walked down to the basement, as the workers scurried out of sight. Now she knew the reason for their discomfort. News must have spread fast. Still, they were wrong. A body lay on the floor, the face covered by a small cloth. She knelt down beside it as Mr. Gaylard lifted the cloth. Bloodshot eyes stared up at the ceiling. A tongue, thick and swollen, protruded from the open mouth. None of these strangled features were familiar. Not really Jack's at all. The stuck-out ears were his, though. She pushed a lock of hair off his forehead.
What have you done?
She whispered, the words coming out as barely a hiss of breath.
What have you done?
The rope he'd used was still looped around his neck, the frayed end curled beside his head like a serpent. His cheek was cold. This Jack wasn't her Jack, who'd walk into the room at any moment and laugh at all this silliness. The husband who'd cried when they'd exchanged vows. No, this was the body of a stranger. Mr. Gaylard took her by the arms and led her away, out of the room and into Jack's office, where they'd had that terrible argument. Had that been only a day ago? It seemed like years. She let him place her in a chair. All because of a lost manuscript. She wanted to fix things, make it all fine again. The book could be rewritten. She'd type as he dictated. They'd find Harry and bring him home. But it was too late.
Mrs. Lyons, I'm so sorry for your loss, he said. I can't imagine the pain you must be in, but I must ask you about a note we found near the body.
She looked up. A note? He took a piece of paper out of his pocket and unfolded it.
It appears to be a confession for the thefts.
No, Jack didn't do that. He handed it to her. And she read it, her hands shaking.
I'm sorry for the trouble I caused the library. The fault is mine, as is the shame. Please tell my family I love them. Jack Lyons.
Mr. Gaylard cleared his throat.
I must ask you, and I'm sorry, but I must. Do you know anything about this?
I do not.
The lie was delivered smoothly, easily, over the turbulence of all these new emotions. Loss, disbelief, shock. They came to her in waves, one after the other.
Pearl. How could she tell Pearl her father had killed himself?
And Harry. What a horrible burden for any young child to have. How could Jack have inflicted this on them all? To save his son. He'd done it for Harry's sake. The door opened, and the other officer came in, a groggy Pearl by his side. Laura rushed to the girl and held her as Mr. Gaylard and the officer exchanged whispers. Mr. Gaylard offered a sympathetic look.
Mrs. Lyons, I'm afraid we have to search your apartment again. You and your daughter can wait in here. I'm told your son isn't present.
He's with my parents.
Another lie. She sat with Pearl on her lap, holding her head to her shoulder, singing softly under her breath. Harry was somewhere out there in the alleys and streets, scared and alone. Jack had left her behind, the loss of his manuscript, the unfaithfulness of his wife, and the shameful acts of his son too much to bear. This building had crushed their family, just as if it had crumbled to the ground right on top of them all.
Chapter 25. New York City, 1993.
What do you mean Valentina's missing? What happened?
Sadie tried to make sense of what Luann was telling her. She was still half asleep and caught up in that terrible dream.
I caught the red eye back last night, and when I arrived home, Lonnie was still out on his shift. Valentina is supposed to be here with Robin, getting ready for school. I checked her bed, and she hasn't slept in it.
Her voice was ragged with panic.
She's not with you?
No. Where's Robin?
Same thing. Gone. My God, if something happened to them while I was away, I'll never forgive myself.
Slow down. Let's talk this through. Did anyone see them leave?
The police are here now and are reaching out to the doorman on the street to find out. Lonnie's on his way home. He's the one who suggested I try you.
The police. The seriousness of the situation hit Sadie hard. Her niece and the babysitter had vanished in the night. She tried to come up with ideas of where to find them as she ran the 5 blocks to the brownstone, frantically wondering who could have taken them. And why? It was New York. Anything was possible. Robin was too small to be a caretaker. Sadie had known that right away and should have told Lonnie so. How could a tiny person like that protect another tiny person? If they had been kidnapped, they would have been easy pickings. When she arrived, Lonnie and Luann were sitting on the couch, ashen-faced, as two policemen asked them questions. Lonnie rose and hugged Sadie.
I'm so glad you're here.
Any news? He shook his head.
The cops have been through both Valentina's and Robin's rooms and found no sign of foul play.
It's like they just disappeared.
Have you checked the hospitals?
We have.
A policeman introduced himself. Sadie didn't catch his name, and started asking questions about Valentina, if she had difficulties at home, if she might have run away.
She's only 6, said Luann.
Of course not.
Lonnie put a hand on her knee.
They have to ask.
Sadie spoke up. What about Robin? Is there family of hers you should call?
I looked through her things for an address book or something like that, but no luck, said Luann. She said she was from somewhere in Massachusetts, I remember.
Another policeman appeared at the front door.
One of the doormen down the street who worked a double shift said he saw them last night around 5:30. He's worked there for years, knew Valentina by name. He said Robin walked by first, and the little girl followed a little later and waved at him. He didn't notice them return, but he could have been busy helping residents if they did.
Hold on, they didn't leave together? Asked Lonnie.
The doorman figured they were, even though the girl passed by a few moments later. Like she was hurrying to catch up.
Strange. Lonnie and Luann exchanged a look. Was anyone else with them? Asked Sadie.
Not that he recalls. He also said that they weren't carrying suitcases or anything.
Maybe they went out for ice cream and something happened,
Luann suggested tearfully. Out there, anything could have happened. 2 young kids, so easily picked up. Picked off. Sadie couldn't sit still. She asked the cop for permission to go into Valentina's room. Valentina had always been neat, with everything in its place. Sadie walked over to the small vanity where the nail polish bottles were all lined up in a row in the order of the rainbow. Her heart broke at the thought of this little girl out somewhere strange, lost and alone. They had to find her, make sure she was safe, protect her. Sadie shouldn't have gone to London and left them. Maybe she would have been here when the kidnappers came and stopped it. And poor Luann. How horrible for her to come home to an eerily empty house. She opened the closet door, where Valentina's clothes hung, mostly varying hues of purple and pink, her favorite colors. Her shoes paired up on the floor below. The bookcase was overflowing with books and games and silly knickknacks, including a jewelry box with a ballerina who twirled about when opened. Inside was one of Pearl's rings. A pearl, of course, which brought tears to Sadie's eyes. Valentina's favorite games were stacked up on the bottom shelf. Connect Four, Clue, a box of Uno cards. Sadie glanced back at the closet. Up on the top shelf, high above the clothes, sat the box for Operation, Valentina's favorite game of all time. The last time they'd played it was with Pearl, when the game had descended into tears and chaos. Sadie had promised to get new batteries, but then forgotten. Odd that it was on the top shelf. Valentina was too short to have placed it up there easily, not without having to pull over a chair to stand on. Sadie lifted it down and placed it on Valentina's bed. Inside, the buzzer still didn't work. Something was off, though. The cardboard piece where the goofy patient lay on his back, staring at her with alarm, was worn and bent along one side. She didn't remember it looking this beat up before. Like it had been removed and then replaced. Maybe Valentina had been curious as to how it worked, or tried to replace the batteries herself. But then how did it end up hidden away in the top of the closet? She pried off the top of the operating table. Underneath lay a folded piece of paper. Old paper, brown and crinkled at the edges. She unfolded it and dropped it on the bed like it was on fire.
Lonnie!
He and Luann came rushing in.
Look!
They stared down at the page, where Shakespeare's face stared right back.
Is that the page that was stolen? Asked Lonnie. The one you told me about?
Yes, from Shakespeare's first folio.
By now, the policeman had joined them. Sadie explained about the missing page, then turned back to Lonnie.
Why on earth would Valentina have this?
I have no idea.
In fact, the children's game was the perfect hiding spot. But not for Valentina.
How much do we know about Robin?
Lonnie's eyebrows knitted with concern.
That she worked as a nanny for those twins we saw in the park. I called her references and checked them out.
That was easy enough to fake. Just ask a friend to make up a story. Was Robin here last night when I called from London? Lonnie nodded.
I was in the kitchen. I'm not sure where she and Valentina were exactly, but they were both here in the townhouse.
Sadie tried to recall what she'd said to Lonnie. She'd definitely filled him in on the details of her conversation with Miss Quinn, about how the Tamerlane was somewhere deep in the library, and how she suspected that meant the apartment. Could Robin have been listening in on the extension?
I suppose, but why would she?
Lonnie, think back. Is there a chance that she would listen to our weekly check-in calls when I told you about what was going on at the library?
Again, I have no idea. What are you getting at?
We have to go to the library, now. Luann, you stay here in case they return in the meantime.
Luann rose.
No, I want to come with you.
Lonnie took her hand in his.
Please, stay, so one of us is here if they do come back.
Reluctantly, Luann relented. Sadie grabbed her coat and made one call before they left, to Nick. His answering machine picked up, but she left a message, telling him it was urgent and to meet them at the library. She hadn't seen the danger, and it turned out that it had been right in front of her.
I'm sorry, Ms. Donovan, I can't let you in.
The burly security guard at the library side entrance put up his hand, but couldn't quite meet her eyes. She'd brought the man a cup of coffee a couple of times a week since she'd begun working there and almost felt sorry for him, having to keep her out on Dr. Hooper's orders.
It's important. There's a little girl missing and we think she might be inside.
She'd explained this to the police at Lonnie's, but they'd seemed confused, asking her repeatedly what antique books had to do with the case. And finally she and Lonnie had thrown up their hands and taken off, telling Luann to call the Berg Collection if they got any news.
I'm sorry.
The guard shook his head.
It's okay. They're with me.
Sadie turned to see Nick struggling out of the revolving door, heading straight toward them.
Nick, my niece is missing. I think she's inside the library.
Right. I got your message.
His eyes were wary. He probably thought she was a madwoman trying to worm her way back into the library to steal more books. She didn't care. Valentina came first. But she had to pull herself together if she wanted to get inside.
This is my brother, Lonnie. I think my family was somehow involved in the thefts, but not directly. I found the page from the folio in my niece's bedroom, hidden in a game.
His face hardened. She was explaining this all wrong.
You found the missing folio page.
He looked over at Lonnie.
In your brother's home.
Yes, but he didn't have anything to do with it.
Your niece stole the page? I thought she was like 7 or something.
She's 6, and no, she didn't steal anything. I think her babysitter did.
She looked at Lonnie, who didn't nod his head or affirm her statement, still unwilling to admit she was right. Sadie supposed that doing so meant that he'd put his daughter in harm's way, and it was easier to imagine some other person forced them to leave. Either way, the girl was gone. Panic rose up in Sadie's throat. She thought she might be sick.
The babysitter.
Yes. Please, Nick, she may have brought her inside to find the Tamerlane. I think they're still in here. She's only 6 and probably terrified. Can you at least alert the staff? Tell them to be on the lookout?
All right. Let's go.
She almost collapsed from relief. With Nick on board, they had a chance. He grabbed a walkie-talkie from the information desk.
What did they look like?
Lonnie provided descriptions of Valentina and Robin, and Nick relayed them over the radio, with instructions to begin searching for the duo.
Does the babysitter know the library well? He asked.
Not that I'm aware of. But I think I know where they might have headed. I went to London to see the executor of my grandmother's estate, to find out if there were any links between that earlier robbery and ours. She said that Laura Lyons once alluded to the Tamerlane, and hinted that she knew where it was.
Where is that?
She said, where it should be, yet where it should not. Like a riddle. I'm guessing in the old apartment where they lived when my grandfather was superintendent.
And how does that connect with your niece's babysitter?
I told Lonnie about it over the phone yesterday, and I think Robin may have been listening in. In fact, looking back, the thefts track with what I mentioned to Lonnie over the phone, about whatever I was working on for the exhibit.
So you think this woman rushed here to beat you to it?
He still didn't quite believe her, she could tell.
Yes. According to a doorman down the street who spotted them, they left with enough time to get into the library right before closing.
It's not yet open to the public, so I'm hoping maybe they're still in here.
Show me.
She led them to the mezzanine level, where the old apartment used to be. When Sadie had first seen it, it had reminded her of that one closet in every house that was jammed with random detritus. But this morning, it looked far worse than usual. The box's contents spilled out, covering the floors. Sadie turned to Lonnie and Nick.
Robin was here, looking for the Tamerlane.
They waded their way through the litter of paper, checking each room. The farthest one at the end of the hall was locked. Sadie banged on the door, called out for Valentina. No answer. Nick called on the walkie-talkie for someone to bring a key.
Do you think Robin found the book?
Asked Lonnie.
It's hard to tell, said Sadie.
He let out a soft moan.
Please, God, let Valentina be okay. This place is huge. They could be anywhere.
Don't worry, said Sadie. We'll find them. I want to go to the art and architecture room to look at the floor plan I requested last week. It might give us a sense of how Robin has been getting around the library, or where she might be hiding.
I'll stay here and wait for the key, and keep on looking, said Nick.
In the art and architecture room, the clerk handed over the old floor plans. Sadie rolled them out on the nearest table, Lonnie peering over her shoulder.
You can see the mezzanine area clearly here.
She pointed to the location of the apartment.
These were the bedrooms,
This was the kitchen and living area.
What's that?
Lonnie pointed to a small square marked with an X, located inside one of the columns. Sadie scanned the page, counting almost a dozen similar markings scattered through the library, including the center section of the reading room.
It's a dumbwaiter. They're dumbwaiters. Here's the one that runs between the reading room and the stacks. There's another here and here.
That's it. That's how Robin's been scurrying around without being detected. She remembered the way the thief disappeared into thin air after Sadie had chased her to the third floor. Sure enough, there on the plans was another X, this time in the women's restroom, which originally had been a study room.
It's like a vertical maze.
Robin's tiny enough to fit, I suppose, said Lonnie. Do you think they're hiding out in the dumbwaiter?
His expression turned to horror.
That's where Valentina is?
Sadie suppressed a shiver. I hope not. I didn't see anything like that in the old apartment. It would have been right where we were standing. Nick was still waiting for the key when they returned, and hadn't found the book either. Sadie filled him in on what they'd discovered and marked the spot, a few feet from the top of the stairs where the dumbwaiter should have been. A clean wall presented itself, with no sign of an open shaft. Nick began knocking on the wall, and the sound changed from solid at the edges to hollow in the middle.
There's definitely an opening here.
Sadie searched the room where the janitor's supplies were kept and found a rusty old toolbox. Nestled inside was a hammer which she handed to Nick. He swung at the column, not too hard, but enough to crack through the plaster. It crumbled easily, and together they pulled it off, eventually revealing a paneled door. Lonnie joined in, pulling off the chunks of wall, and soon they had enough of an opening to view the entire dumbwaiter. The dark wood was smooth and pristine, kept safe from exposure behind the false front, clasped shut with a metal latch. Nick clicked the latch and opened the door. Inside, the interior shaft was dark, ominous, and filthy. The dumbwaiter car wasn't lined up with the opening, the bottom edge resting a few inches below the top of the doorframe. Nick leaned in, looking down.
Valentina!
He called out. The sound echoed back up at them. Lonnie looked like he was about to be sick. There was no answer. Nothing.
See if you can lower the dumbwaiter car so it's even, said Sadie.
Nick reached up and tried to pull it down with his hands, but no luck. He grasped one of the two lines of rope that ran down one side of the shaft, and the shelf slowly creaked down. In the very middle of the car sat a wooden box. Sadie reached in and lifted it out carefully as if it were a religious relic. Inside were some old bills, and beneath that, a worn-looking book with an olive-green cover. The Tamerlane. They'd found the book.
What does this mean? Asked Lonnie. What about Valentina?
The radio squawked again. Sadie jumped at the sound. What now?
We found the little girl.
The voice came from the radio, a man's baritone.
Down in the basement, in the bindery. We found the girl.
Sadie almost tumbled down the stairs. Her legs wouldn't move fast enough. She held onto the railing to keep from falling, but really wanted to throw herself down to the bottom level, to the basement. If something had happened to Valentina here in the library, she would never forgive herself. Lonnie beside her was pale and panting. At the bottom of the stairs, Nick took off down the long hallway like a high school football player. Sadie and Lonnie followed him along what seemed like an endless passageway. It reminded Sadie of recurring nightmares where she was in a hurry to get somewhere, but the destination was murky and always out of reach. Inside the bindery, Valentina sat at a table, a book in front of her, with Mr. Babenko standing nearby. She looked up and smiled. Lonnie ran to her and grabbed her in his arms.
My girl.
Valentina's smile quickly changed to alarm.
I'm sorry.
What are you sorry for, my love?
Asked Lonnie.
I don't know.
At that, Valentina began to sob. Sadie wrapped her arms around both of them, not sure of what to say. She had so many questions, but didn't want to scare the girl any more than she already was.
We were just putting a jacket on a new library book, said Mr. Babenko. She's quite good, I must say. Has a delicate touch.
Valentina broke off her crying and looked up at him.
I do?
You do. Here, show them what you've done.
Valentina picked up the book, which was wrapped in shiny, clear mylar.
I put the sticker with the call number on it here, see? Then we do this wrapping like a Christmas present, but see-through.
Well done, my girl.
Lonnie stood and addressed Mr. Babenko.
Thank you for finding her. Oh, she found me, I must say.
Valentina remained seated at the table, not in any hurry to leave. Sadie took the chair next to her. Valentina was safe. That was what mattered most.
Mr. Babenko, can my brother use your phone to call home? Let them know she's safe?
Mr. Babenko nodded. Lonnie went to his desk and dialed. As he spoke in a low voice with Luann, Sadie turned to Valentina.
How did you end up here, V? Did Robin leave you last night, at home?
Valentina didn't answer, but she didn't have to. Her eyes grew wide at Robin's name. Sadie put a hand on Valentina's shoulder.
You can tell us. It's okay.
I'd lost another tooth, and she said she had to see the tooth fairy, that she'd bring me back a present.
She left you alone in the townhouse?
She told me I could watch TV until I fell asleep. But I wanted to see the tooth fairy too, so I followed her, right to the library and up to that big room at the top with all the desks.
Valentina would have felt at home in the building, as she'd visited Sadie there multiple times, and with the hordes of tourists coming in and out of the reading room, she would have blended right in.
She went into one of the doors.
The reading room. Sadie tried to picture where she might have gone.
Where exactly?
Inside was a curvy staircase.
Sadie knew immediately what she was referring to. By now, Lonnie had returned, and she directed her reply to him. It's one of a few doors that line both sides of the reading room. The spiral staircase inside leads to a railed walkway that runs above the shelves. When she'd first been hired, the new employees had been given a behind-the-scenes tour, where they'd been taken up the spiral staircase, onto the walkway, and then out to a balcony that led to a sweeping view of Bryant Park. Thank goodness Valentina hadn't gotten that far. The enclosed spiral staircase would have made the perfect hiding space for Robin, until the library shut down for the evening. After everyone was gone, she would have had easy access to the stacks via the dumbwaiter at the delivery desk. How she got inside the Berg's cage, though, was still a question.
Did you follow her through the door? Sadie asked.
It was locked. I walked along the shelves to the very end and sat down to wait for her. And I must have fallen asleep.
A low row of bookshelves about 4 feet high ran just in front of the wall containing the door. If Valentina had tucked herself in there, she would have been out of sight of the librarians closing up. Sadie imagined the dark library at night, with all its creaks and groans.
That must have been very scary, V.
It was. When I woke up, the door in the wall was unlocked again, but Robin wasn't inside. I wandered around for a while. Then I found this room, and there was a couch.
She pointed to the corner where a sofa was pushed against a wall.
So I lay down.
Mr. Babenko took over the story.
When I came in this morning, there she was, fast asleep. I called up to security to say that we had a visitor, and we did some work together in the meantime.
Sadie was grateful for Mr. Babenko's kindness, that he'd done everything he could to keep Valentina calm and safe.
Security is guarding the exits, said Nick. If Robin's still here, we'll find her.
The police arrived, and Sadie gave her niece a huge hug before watching Lonnie and Valentina go off with them. She turned to Nick.
We should loop in Dr. Hooper. Bring him the Tamerlane.
Right. I'll wrap up down here. Why don't you take it up and I'll meet you at Hooper's office?
She appreciated the opportunity to explain what they'd deduced, even if they didn't have all the answers.
Will do.
Hand it over. Nick froze.
I don't have the book. You have it, right?
Sadie thought back. She had had it, but couldn't remember much of anything once they'd heard that Valentina was found. She could have sworn Nick had picked it up. She checked her purse in case she'd put it away there. Nothing. The hairs on her arms prickled, and the room felt like it was spinning around her. I don't have it. In all the rush to come down here, it must have been forgotten.
Then it must still be up in the room.
The thought made Sadie ill. She followed Nick out the door.
Chapter 26. New York City, 1918.
Do you need help, Mother?
Laura smiled at her daughter and handed her one of the bags of groceries. That would be lovely. In the 4 years since Jack's suicide and their eviction from the library, Pearl had turned into Laura's helpmeet, doing exactly what she should, when she should, and going above and beyond to make sure things were just right. As if she could make up for the loss of her father and brother, and Laura's anguish. Laura knew it was unwise to take her good nature for granted, but days like today, when she was beat down with loss and worry for Harry, she welcomed it wholeheartedly.
I made a lemon sponge cake, said Pearl,
pointing to the top of the oven, where it sat cooling,
for Harry's birthday.
Tears sprang into Laura's eyes.
That's so kind of you.
They both stared at the cake for a moment, knowing that Harry would never taste it. He'd not come back to the library that day, nor come to his grandparents' brownstone after Pearl and Laura had taken refuge there. Refuge that didn't last long, as her father's disapproval and contempt became insufferable. Finally, Laura had packed them up again and headed downtown. Amelia answering the door without a word and ushering them inside her apartment at Patchin Place, where they'd been ever since.
Do you mind if I run over to Sarah's for a bit? Asked Pearl.
Of course.
And we'll have our cake after dinner. You're a love.
Laura watched as she headed out, noting that the hem of her dress needed to be taken down again. At 11, she'd sprung up several inches. Pearl seemed to enjoy living in Greenwich Village and had made friends with the other children who lived on the alley. If she had any resentments, she didn't let them out, and Laura chose not to pry. When she'd pried in the past, she discovered answers that ruined everything. Maybe later, when Pearl was grown up, she and Laura would be able to speak on the matter, but not yet. Amelia had been a good friend and partner the past 4 years, taking over when Laura had her spells and couldn't get out of bed. Luckily, they were occurring further and further apart these days. Since her own tragedy, the United States had entered and then won a war, and now, after an anxious and precarious time, a sense of optimism finally seemed to be winding its way back into daily life. That same hopefulness had slowly seeped into Laura, and every so often she even experienced short bursts of joy, like the day she deposited her first paycheck into her very own bank account. She was glad she had the financial freedom she'd always hoped for, but she'd never imagined obtaining it this way. The loss of half her family burned into her like a branding iron, a mark that would never fade. The day after Jack's death, Dr. Anderson had told them they had to leave. She'd stood on the steps of the library, Pearl weeping by her side, holding whatever they could fit into their suitcases. Dr. Anderson had apologized, explaining that he had no choice, and handed her an envelope of money. She'd refused it,
but had thanked him for his past kindness. It wasn't his fault. That day, Laura had vowed to never be financially dependent upon another person again. As the shock of their changed circumstances wore off, Laura began to see her past life in a new light, one that was slightly less filled with self-loathing. With Amelia, the workload of taking care of Pearl and running a household was shared, which meant Laura had more time to spare. What if she and Jack had shared the work of domestic life, been true equals both inside and outside the home? Then her year at Columbia wouldn't have been such a shock to their children, and Harry might not have been so vulnerable, not fallen into Red Patty's clutches. What if, as a rule, husbands helped out more around the house instead of putting their work ahead of family, the way Jack had done? It wasn't all her fault, and maybe it wasn't so terrible that she'd wanted more out of life. Once she'd had enough time to gather both her thoughts and her courage, she'd marched into Marie Jenny Howe's parlor, prepared to see a sour expression on the woman's beautiful features. Marie's hand rested on the neck of a guitar she'd been playing, and she motioned for Laura to sit. "I would like to make a proposal." Laura had run through the speech in her head multiple times, but the compassion in Marie's eyes stopped her cold. She didn't want pity. "What's that, Mrs. Lyons? And may I say how sorry I am for your loss?" Laura took a deep breath. "Thank you. I would like to interview a member of the club each week and write about who they are, what they're doing." "That's an audacious idea, coming from you." Marie's sympathy went only so far. But after dealing with Professor Wakeman's resistance, Laura knew how to handle the same from Marie. She owed him thanks for that, at least. The only way for women to gain equality, true equality, inside and outside of the home, is to showcase the accomplishments of those who are out there changing the world, as a way to inspire others to reach for more as well. "I've spoken with Max Eastman at the Masses, and he thinks the column is a grand idea. We both know the article that ran in the World was edited by a man, and his perspective warped the interpretation. Mr. Eastman has promised me full editorial control over each essay. This will be our story."
"Don't you mean your story?"
"My story is intertwined in everyone else's, I see that now. I can't stand apart from the causes that are dear to me as a woman. I failed out of Columbia, and I no longer want to be a reporter. I want to editorialize, convince people that their way of thinking is out of date, and use words as a means to change minds." Marie, after speaking with Mr. Eastman, had agreed to allow Laura to interview her and use her as the first source, a test of sorts. Their conversation had run deep into the night, and the resulting essay had stirred controversy with its candor and passion, which pleased Mr. Eastman and Marie to no end. Much to Laura's selfish relief, Amelia's offer to move to London had been suspended as the clouds of war roiled over Europe. For this, she was grateful. At Patchin Place, they loved each other quietly and furtively, but without the grand passion as before. This was an arrangement that suited them both, and their natures fit easily together because the relationship was balanced. Neither had more power than the other. The members of the Heterodoxy Club had eventually warmed back up to Laura and allowed her to attend meetings, where she came up with more ideas for the column than she could write in a lifetime. Here she was, living the life she'd dreamed about before everything else fell apart. Living in the village with the woman she adored more than anyone else in the world, working as a writer, and part of a community that welcomed eccentricity and change. But she hadn't wanted it in this way, at the expense of Jack and Harry. At dinner that evening, Pearl lit and blew out the single candle on Harry's cake.
Happy 15th birthday, my boy, said Laura quietly under her breath. Amelia handed Pearl a knife. It looks delicious. So many bland words. How silly they all looked, having a cake for a boy who wanted nothing to do with them. Red Patty's gang is back on 4th Avenue, said Amelia as Pearl handed her a plate. I have my inspectors keeping an eye out for you. Harry had been spotted several times over the years since Laura had taken to making near daily treks through the Lower East Side in the hopes of catching a glimpse of her son. But he had always disappeared into the crowds or around the corner before she could reach him. Over time, she'd gotten to know his roots, but he'd made it clear that he'd run if she got too close. Her sightings, though sporadic, gave her hope. One of these days, she'd reach him again. Thank you, said Laura. To think he's 15 now. Almost a man. Laura didn't look at Amelia, and instead tried a small bite of cake. It's lovely, Pearl. Well done. He's been on his own for 4 years now, Laura. Amelia wasn't going to let up once she got started. It might be time. I can't leave. Pearl would like London, wouldn't you, my girl? We can visit the Tower and Buckingham Palace, now that the war's over and it's safe to travel. Amelia didn't have to add that her job offer still stood, and that it would be a boon to her career in public health. Laura couldn't leave New York when her boy was still wandering its streets, likely still in pain. I would like that. Pearl, always trying to take care of them both. I could learn to make scones. I'm going out, said Laura. She didn't want to have this discussion, not on this day, and it irritated her to no end that Amelia would bring it up. They'd have a long talk about it later that night, no doubt, and Amelia would apologize and hold her close. But that wouldn't change anything, not in Laura's mind. The sting of the October air in her lungs was a shock after a warm few days, punctuated with a light drizzle. Soon enough, she'd need to fetch out the gloves and scarves. Where did Harry get his clothes from? Did he steal them, like he had the books? The adorable boy she'd raised, with his bow-shaped lips and sparkling eyes, could not be reconciled with the feral young man living on the streets who no longer needed her. She carried his stuffed lamb in her bag when she went out looking for him, although she wasn't sure why. Red Patty would probably laugh and toss it in the gutter if she dared to pull it out. Only one of the bookstores on 4th Avenue was still open at this late hour. She entered to escape from the rain, breathing in the unique smell of the old books, a musty mix of vanilla and wet wood. When she'd lived at the library, she'd sometimes buried her head in one of the books and inhaled, even when the other patrons gave her strange looks. Better than any perfume, Jack had agreed.
I got something for you.
The voice was familiar. She peeked around a bookshelf to the back of the store, where a cashier stared down at a reedy boy wearing a cap, red curls wrapping around his neck like worms. Red Patty. The cashier sighed and put an elbow on the counter.
What now?
Red Patty pulled a book out from his coat. So they were still at it. The gang probably had moved on to other libraries or stole from other bookshops. It was a lucrative business. The cashier shook his head and returned to his newspaper, ignoring the protestations of Red Patty, who eventually gave up and sauntered out. Laura followed at a distance, the red hair like a beacon under the street lamps, until Red Patty reached a building on 2nd Avenue. He scampered down a stairway into a basement entrance. After a moment to gather her courage, Laura followed. The door opened into a hallway so narrow a burly man would have to shift sideways to get through. To the right was a door, and she could hear Red Patty swearing from inside.
bastard wouldn't take it.
Murmuring from other boys followed. She didn't hear Harry, even though her ear was pressed close. She could knock, but that would give them time to run. Instead, she turned the knob, relieved and also terrified when she met no resistance and the door swung open. She almost reeled back from the stench, a mix of sweat, alcohol, and rubbish. One tiny window near the street offered the only light, and just beneath it, three small boys sprawled against an upturned barrel, fast asleep. In the far corners of the room, stuffed mattresses covered rickety-looking lofts, and a table of sorts was pushed against one wall, holding the remains of what looked like last week's breakfast.
"Are you a charity lady?"
said Red Patty, nonplussed.
"Going to give us a speech, are you?"
By now, her eyes had adjusted to the darkness. There, at the table, sat a boy who stared back at her with an electric shock, who lacked the disdain of the others. Her boy, Harry. The first year that they moved into the library, Jack had come up to dinner one evening complaining about the difficulty of fixing a leak in the basement, where a crawl space narrowed almost to nothing.
"Can't reach it for the life of me."
Harry had offered to help, but Laura had dismissed the idea as too dangerous. Jack studied his son as if he was seeing him for the first time, sized him up, and announced that it was worth a try. Together, they disappeared after dinner and returned an hour later, both covered in muck and grinning madly. Harry had been able to reach the leak and patched it, following his father's instructions. The next day, Harry dashed into his room after school, pulled on his overalls, and told Laura he was going to work. She nodded solemnly, not wanting to let on how adorable he appeared. He returned less than 15 minutes later, in tears. Jack, caught up in whatever crisis had arisen that day, had roughly dismissed Harry, forgetting that he was only a little boy who just wanted to help. After dinner, Laura tried to explain to Jack why Harry was hurt, but Jack hadn't listened.
"The boy's too sensitive," Jack said, before turning away.
In the dankness of the tenement basement, Laura's sensitive boy stared at her with huge eyes. This was her only chance. "Harry, let me buy you something to eat. That's all I want to do." She'd guessed correctly. He was hungry. He glanced down at the detritus on the table and then checked in with Red Patty, who leaned against one of the lofts and raised his eyebrows. "Please." She locked eyes with Red Patty.
Red Patty shrugged. "He can do what he likes. I'm not in charge of him."
As they walked up Second Avenue, Laura kept her arms tight to her side. She reminded herself that she mustn't touch him, mustn't reach out to grasp his hand or his arm, even if not doing so went against her every instinct. It took her a moment to get used to his height. He was now as tall as she was. This was a new Harry, and she'd have to treat him carefully, not baby him or beg him to come home. They settled in at a Russian restaurant and ordered blintzes. She tried not to stare as he tore into the food. All those boys in that room, growing and needing to eat. What was dinner time like for them? A fight over whatever scraps they could scrounge together, probably. "Pearl made a cake for your birthday." "When was it?" He didn't even know. "Today. Do you not know the date?"
"No."
Of course he didn't. He must have outgrown the pair of glasses they'd bought together so long ago. Without them, reading a newspaper would be impossible. "Why don't you come home and have a piece? It's delicious. And we saved you plenty."
"No, thanks."
He glanced up at her, then back to his food, as if it might be snatched from him if he didn't put it away fast enough. I don't want to live with you and Father anymore. I don't need to. He trailed off. Laura's mouth went dry. He didn't know his father was dead. Dr. Anderson and Mr. Gaylard had successfully covered up the suicide, so it hadn't made the news. Of course, they'd been more concerned with protecting the institution's reputation than maintaining discretion for Jack's family. She took a ragged breath, focused on keeping a semblance of composure. Harry didn't seem to notice, engrossed as he was in his meal. She couldn't tell him, not yet. We've missed you.
You wouldn't. Not if you knew what I've done.
The manuscript? That's over with. Done. No one.